Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This appeal arises from Mr. Calvin Bruce's crack conviction and sentence. There are two aspects of that that require this Court's attention. First is the conviction itself. The District Court's refusal to give a jury instruction on the unlawfulness of Mr. Bruce's custodial interrogation deprived him of a key defense.
I don't understand. What on earth would a jury do with something like that? They're in a federal case, and then they're told this investigator violated a state law. What are they supposed to do, especially in a jury instruction? What are they supposed to do?
What weight
do they give it?
Sure.
What issue does it bear on?
Well, I think Your Honor's hit the fundamental question. It's the structure of the jury instruction, which is set out in our appendix at page 7. The first point was to tell the jury, look, this is a matter of Wisconsin law. When we have a custodial interrogation, the law presumes that these things are going to be recorded.
How does that bear on the issue of his guilt?
It bears on the issue of his guilt in, I think, two important ways. First, Your Honor, with respect to the fact that this is a law, it's not just the fact that this was a custodial interrogation that was unrecorded. It's beyond that, the fact that the judgment of the good people of the state of Wisconsin have required this as a matter of law be done. The reason it matters is because when you can show that an officer is violating the law, all people are, of course, presumed to know the law. If an officer is violating the law when taking this statement, certainly doesn't that call into question whether the statement in fact happened, first of all, and second of all, to the extent that it did, whether what was testified to have been said in that statement is actually true. The reason that matters is very specific to this case, which is that we had 52 minutes of a tape-recorded confession that went exactly like the law in Wisconsin envisions.
But that doesn't have anything to do whether it's a legal requirement. The point is, if they stop the tape, of course you wonder what on earth was it in the part that wasn't recorded. That's fine, but I don't see why telling them it's a violation of Wisconsin law does anything except confuse them, since they're not being asked to decide Wisconsin law, right? It's not a Wisconsin law case.
Certainly that's right. It's a federal drug case. But it goes to, again, what weight ought we to be giving this confession? It's more than just the circumstances.
Well, your argument is that the police witnesses were not credible, and evidence of their being not credible is that 52 minutes were recorded and there was no inculpatory statements were made, and then the recorders turned off. Now they claim that inculpatory statements. So it goes to the weight that should be attached to their testimony.
That's exactly right, Judge Evans, and I think this Court put it well in Wilderness, which is even if the judge determines that a confession is voluntary for purposes of federal law, which is the issue I think Judge Shabazz got hung up on, and thus not to be precluded under the Fourth Amendment, a defendant is still entitled to encourage the jury to discount the confession in light of the circumstances that would diminish.
Not in light of the state law.
Well, the state law, as I think Judge Evans was pointing out, is in fact a key circumstance here.
Look, if you just remove the first paragraph from your instruction, the substance is the same. It's just not a reference to Wisconsin law anymore.
Right, but I think the fact that there is, it's not just that we ought to be careful about custodial interrogations. And certainly that was inherent in the instruction given, but it's a step beyond that. We're being careful because it's against the law not to do
very
this.
Prejudicial to the government.
Well, certainly it's prejudicial to the government.
Well, but, you know, Rule 403, you're supposed to balance prejudice against probative weight. Probative weight is very limited, since the key thing is the stopping the recording, not whether it's legal or illegal. That's the key thing. The legal thing has limited probative significance, but is prejudicial and confusing.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The point is, when we've got people, again, the federal government here has chosen to rely on the agents of the police department of the state of Wisconsin. These people, when they act, are presumed to know the law of Wisconsin. They violated that law, and I think it's important that a jury here, when they're considering whether this inculpatory evidence that comes out of entirely the part of the transcript that wasn't recorded, I think it's important for the jury to know that these people were violating the law when these statements supposedly happened, if indeed they ever happened at all.
Well, but Judge Posner is right. The issue really is going to be here, if there is an error, whether it's harmless under the circumstances. And it seems to me the critical thing, and what you argued, what the defense argued, was don't believe that he said these things to the police because they turned the recorder off. The jury knew that.
I think that's right, but they knew that they turned the recorder off without knowing that, in fact, they weren't supposed to turn the recorder off. Right now, you might think it's up to the police. Hey, maybe we leave the recorder on, maybe we don't.
This law had only been on the books for 60 days, so maybe
60 days by the time he'd been arrested, yes. And in fact,
this law was only on it for 60 days, and that you have to record all these kind of interrogations. So maybe they never filtered down. Them. I don't know.
It could be, but certainly if we were here in some sort of criminal case where the only criminal law had only been on the book for 60 days, certainly we wouldn't say the defendant should be.
That's a substantive crime. That's a different story. But here, this is a procedural matter. Maybe these people have taken hundreds of confessions, and whenever somebody indicates they're going to start cooperating, they turn it off.
They
don't want to have to turn that over to the some defendant in some other case.
I understand your point, and I think that's exactly the point. This is a procedural point, and we ought not, you know, blow this up into something that it's
Isn't
not.
It's Rule 404B evidence.
Yes. No.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
It's
okay.
Bad acts.
Yes.
Bad acts. Yeah.
Well, it's evidence of this case. It's not prior bad acts.
Yes, it is. It's prior to the trial.
Yeah, but that returns bad acts by a defendant, not by... You're talking about the witness having done something in violation.
Well, that's right.
I'm sorry.
I don't want to confuse this. My point is simply this. A jury instruction is supposed to be given, if it's an accurate statement of the law, it was that here, no dispute, even if it was a new law. If it's supported by evidence, which in fact it was here, no dispute on that, not already part of the charge, I think we've covered that, and deprives the defendant of the fair trial / harmless error. And I think that's the point Judge Evans was getting to. And the simple point is here, the inculpatory stuff that, you know, Mr. Bruce wrapped up the stuff with Pepper, the part that where he purchased this stuff, and the fact that he identified the bigger drug dealer, all of that happened, interestingly, after the tape gets shut off. That's something the jury should have been able to hear, was that, in fact, after the tape was shut off, it should not have been, as a matter of Wisconsin law. Let me move on to the second issue, which is perhaps a little more straightforward, the sentencing issue here. When Mr. Bruce was sentenced, he was sentenced pursuant to the drug level.
In light of the government's brief, is there a disagreement about what we should do about the sentence?
I think there is, Your Honor, only for this reason. The government's brief, I think, first makes an argument that a Palladino remand wasn't preserved here. We disagree with that. But the bigger question, this comes out of this court's decision in Taylor, I think points the way to where we need to go. Baked into this question of the variance issue, there's also a question of that the guideline itself changed, the drug quantity guideline. So while Mr. Bruce was sentenced at an offense level of 38 under the drug quantity guideline, the very next day after his sentence, it changed, and it would have been a 36. And in fact, in March of 2008.
What difference would that make to his sentence?
Well, that's the thing. We don't know. When that's made retroactive, instead of starting with a baseline of 38 under the drug quantity table and sentencing accordingly with discretion, which the district court didn't know it had at the time, presumably if you'd have to have the district court recalculate. On the record, it looks like what you'd end up doing is using the career offender level, which brings into to play a whole different set of circumstances that weren't present. I mean, really, I think the only proper way to handle this is to remand pursuant to what the court did in the Taylor case and let the judge have at it again with the new guideline and then make the variance.
When was the sentencing guideline changed?
The sentencing guideline was changed November 1st, 2007 and made retroactive in March of 2008.
His sentencing. When he was sentenced?
The day after.
He was sentenced after the new law took effect, the new guidelines.
He was sentenced the day before the new law took effect. And this is, I think, the point the court makes in Joyce.
Why is it retroactively applicable?
In March of 2008, the Sentencing Commission made the guideline retroactively applicable. This is the point that came up in Joyce.
That means everybody gets resentenced?
Right.
Everybody?
You can ask for it on your own motion. The district court, and this is the point the court here made in the Taylor case, you can ask for it. The court could do it on its own motion. The Board of Paroles could do it. Since this is, in fact, no longer right, we ought to let the district court judge start with the correct guideline and then act accordingly in light of Kimbrough.
Okay, fine. Thank you, Mr. Murray. Mr. Rumbelow?
Good morning, Your Honors. Rita Rumbelow for the United States. Judge Posner, you are absolutely correct that whether...
He likes it when an argument starts that way.
Pardon me? Oh.
No, it didn't stall.
The fact that, Detective Reisler allegedly, and I do use the term allegedly, violated this Wisconsin statute was completely irrelevant. First and foremost, I mean, federal law doesn't require law enforcement officers to record statements at all, period. If a DEA agent goes out and conducts a custodial interrogation, they don't have to record. This was a federal trial. I also used the term, and I used it in my brief, you know, an alleged violation.
Well, that's a reason for not suppressing the statement. But why not let it in that this was taken in violation of the state law?
No, because the state law provides that if the officer has good cause, they don't have to record. They never asked below. They never asked Judge Shabazz to make a decision on whether or not good cause existed in this case. But clearly, Detective Reisler explained to the jury why she shut it off. He now, it was no longer supposed to be an interrogation.
Is that good cause that you're, I think good cause is that the tape broke or something like that.
That's
not
no.
that I just decided I'm not going to record it anymore.
Well, no, he started cooperating against other individuals. And like you noted, Judge Evans, they didn't want that ever ending up, you know, with some in another defendant's hands. But again, that's definitely not a decision for the jury to decide. So it was completely irrelevant whether or not she violated the Wisconsin statute. She explained her reasons. They were instructed under 3.02. What weight, if any, the defense was...
She said she turned it off because he was beginning to name names.
Oh, yes. And in fact, I mean, in very little of that unrecorded conversation was introduced at trial. Yes, he wrapped the cocaine in pepper. That's what he always does. But we corroborated. I mean, during the unrecorded portion of his statement, he identified his drug supplier. He initialed the photo of his drug supplier, and we introduced that in evidence at trial. So, again, the jury was instructed what weight, if any, to give this statement. Well, you know, he did initial his drug dealer's photo. So they deliberated. They decided they gave it great weight. So they're absolutely...
What is it you want to do about... What is the disagreement over the sentence?
Okay. Under the narrow holding of Kimbrough... This court has held, and defense provided a copy of United States versus Clanton in its 28J letter, which cites Harris, just two very recent cases from this court. A sentence entered under the career offender guidelines, 4B1.1, raises no Kimbrough problem because to the extent it treats crack cocaine differently from powder cocaine, the disparity arises from the statute, not from the sentencing guidelines. So in this case, it's undisputed that Mr. Bruce is a career offender. He has two prior felony drug convictions for distributing controlled substances. The 2D1.1 amendment has absolutely no bearing on his sentence as a career offender. He cannot go lower than a level 37. So the
guideline... Well, the sentence could be lower, though, right?
No. Under the broader holding of Kimbrough, possibly, but they waived it.
No,
under the narrow holding...
No. Take Kimbrough out of the equation. The judge could still sentence him lower than the guideline range, right?
Under the broader holding of Kimbrough, district court could disagree because the guidelines are advisory. You're right. Okay, let's take Kimbrough out of the equation. The guidelines are advisory. You're correct. But they can only disagree with the career offender guidelines based on a policy disagreement with them, not based on the 100-to-1 disparity.
Right. True, but?
So here, they never raised or developed any argument about that disparity under the broader holding of Kimbrough as it applies to the career offender.
They can only disagree with the guidelines under a policy disagreement?
The career offender, yes. Because Kimbrough doesn't affect the career offender guidelines at all.
Well,
they're driven by statute.
It does in a way, doesn't it? Your category as a career offender is based on what the maximum sentence is for your crime of conviction. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. And if you have powder cocaine, it might be 20 years. But if you have over 5 grams of crack, it might be 40 years. So if you have a 40-year sentence, a sentence, I think it's over 25 years, this is kind of convoluted stuff.
No, I'm fine. I understand what you're saying.
I think it says if your maximum sentence is 25 years or more, which it isn't as a crack defender, then you're at this level for an armed career or a career criminal. But if your penalty is less than 25 years, which it would be in the 20-year cap for a powder cocaine case, your level is a little, like one or two levels lower.
Absolutely.
Isn't that how it works?
That is exactly how it works.
So why wouldn't this make a difference here?
That's driven by statute. I'm, Your Honor, I'm just, again, two recent decisions of this court, Clanton and Harris, decided on August 6th and August 14th.
Which disregarded an earlier decision of this court and Hearn. But let's get back to the question I tried to ask you. Under Booker,
yes,
is the career offender guideline treated differently than every other section of the guideline?
No, it's still advisory.
It's still advisory. Therefore, a judge can downwardly can give a sentence outside the structure of the guideline. Am I right?
Yes.
Suppose this district judge was under a misapprehension as to how much deference he owed to the 100-to-1 ratio at the time he sentenced this man. Could that not have influenced whether or not he decided to give a sentence other than the guideline sentence?
It could have, but again, the defendant didn't raise it in his opening brief. He completely waived it. And in another recent decision of this court on October 10th, I cited it in my 28-J letter. It's not reviewable. Even if we, you know, said, okay, he raised it somehow, maybe preserved it, even if it's just forfeiture, under plain error, this court held there was no plain error. So the defendant never, ever raised this issue in his opening brief. And he didn't raise it below.
Why under Taylor does he not at least get a conditional remand?
Because he's a career offender.
That's circular.
Right. He wasn't sentenced under 2D1.1. He was sentenced under 4B1. It is very confusing. Trust me, I spent hours and hours getting my head wrapped around the different decisions.
What he argues in his brief is that his offense level should be reduced to 36.
But it can't be because he's a career offender. So he is absolutely
So what you're saying is if that's erroneous, if that's an erroneous legal proposition,
and it is,
then he's out of luck because he hasn't made the general Booker argument. You're saying he hasn't made the general Booker argument that Judge Ripple was referring to. Is that what you're saying?
Right. His only argument in his opening brief is, look, there was an amendment to the crack guidelines under 2D1.1. I'm entitled to a reduction to level 36. That's just wrong as a matter of law because he wasn't sentenced under 2D1.1. He was sentenced under 4B1.1.
He's saying in his brief he's just making a legal point, and that legal point is incorrect.
Yes.
Is that what it amounts to?
Okay. And that's why Taylor doesn't apply, and it doesn't need to be a limited remand on that. And then we pointed out in our brief, because the guidelines are advisory, perhaps the court could disagree with the career offender guideline and sentence below them. But again, they didn't raise that either, and so that's waiver. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Rumbelow. Mr. Murray, does he have any more time? We'll give you a minute or two. Yeah.
If I may, Your Honor, I have three quick points, but I think the most important one, I think we have a fundamental disagreement with the government as to what Mr. Bruce was actually sentenced under. Remember, under 2D1.1, you start with the drug offense level. That was 38 here. That is what he was actually sentenced under. Under 4D1.1, you look at the table based on the sentences imposable, the statutory maxima. That would have yielded an offense level of 37. Then under 41.1 in form, you then look as between those two, which is the higher, and use that. So it was the 38 out of the drug quantity guideline that was actually used here. When you use an offense level out of the drug quantity guideline at 38, that should have been 36, there's error. And as far as I'm concerned, that's all we need to talk about under Taylor where the court said the district judge should hold off on getting into any of this Kimbrough variances until it decides whether to act.
You don't even have to mention Taylor. What you're saying, you seem to have just a straight legal disagreement with the government over whether it should have been 36, right?
No. I mean, where it ends up is it was 38 as it was used.
You say in your brief it should have been 36.
The drug quantity guideline should have been 36.
You said it should be 36, right?
I just want to be clear. The drug quantity guideline.
Look.
Yes, we said the drug quantity.
So if you're wrong about that, you're out of luck, right?
No. And please.
No?
No.
But that's the only argument you make.
The drug quantity guideline should have been 36. As I understand how this would play out, and again, I'm not the district judge or the sentencer.
The changes contained in 2D1, etc., should apply, reducing his offense level to 36. If you're wrong about that, do you have any other argument about the sentence?
Let me see if I can put it this way. The drug quantity offense level...
You can't answer my question.
This is my argument, Judge. The drug quantity offense level should have been 36. That I agree with.
Are you moving away from this argument heading in your brief?
No, Your Honor.
So if you're wrong about that, you're out of luck, unless you have another argument.
The problem is what the government is talking. The drug quantity offense level should have been 36.
What is the problem?
Yes.
You say the changes should apply, reduce his offense level to 36, right? That's your argument. If you're wrong, you have another argument.
The drug quantity offense level should have been 36.
You have another argument.
What the government is...
You have another argument?
It would be a Palladino remand, because that's the provision he was sentenced under.
You haven't argued for that.
We've asked... In the opening brief, we said on the record, it's unclear that Judge Shabazz would have imposed the same sentence absent the 2006 guidelines and the sentencing disparity.
After you've decided that the offense level should be 36.
That's right.
If you don't get it down to 36, do you have anything else you're arguing about the sentence?
As to the drug quantity level, if the drug quantity doesn't go from 38 to 36, there should be a Kimbrough-Palladino remand. Those are the two arguments.
You lost me completely.
And
you
I
have one argument in your brief.
Yes.
You're now adding a second argument.
No. The one argument in my brief is that 38 should have been 36,
right,
and that there was discretion under Kimbrough to vary downward even further from that. Where this gets complicated is the government has taken the position that if we change 38 to 36 in the drug quantity guideline, it doesn't matter, because under the career offender guideline, it would still be 37. And because we somehow didn't raise the point that you could vary downward under Kimbrough or last week's decision in Liddell, with respect to the career offender guideline, that we somehow waived that, even though that's not what happened at sentencing. What happened was it was 38, it should have been 36. Everything else that happens after that is something the judge should take care of on remand.
No, I think the government agrees, because they said it wasn't 36. So I think you're just arguing over whether it was 36. But I had another question. Yeah, what about Ms. Rumbelow's argument that there was good cause because she turned off, Detective Rietzler turned off the recording because he was beginning to name names? Why isn't that good cause?
If you look at page 3 of our reply brief, Detective Rietzler was actually inconsistent in that testimony. She said she turned it off because he was starting to name names. She also testified that she had told him earlier that she would expect his public testimony as to who these people were, which makes sense. If you're going to give the guy a discount because he's going to flip, of course you want him to testify. So she was inconsistent. She also told him that Bruce didn't even know he was being recorded.
Wait a second. You're saying that the claim of good cause is arguable. Was that going to be a jury issue too? That is, if you had gotten this instruction, would then the government have gotten up and say, yeah, it would be unlawful if, but we had good cause? And then you have a trial on whether they had good cause. Is that how this would have unfolded?
No, not at all, Your Honor. All we asked was that the law...
Well, wait a second.
Sure.
What if they argued that that this was lawful?
I mean, certainly they could make that as a jury argument. The jury instruction we requested simply
asked... What if they argue that you're going to hear this instruction about violating the Wisconsin law? There was no violation because there was good cause. Now, would that be permissible for them to do?
Sure.
And then there's going to be a little trial on good cause.
I don't know that we would have to. I mean, there doesn't have to be a trial on good cause. The officers aren't on trial for violating.
It's a factual question.
I mean, this is a jury beyond a reasonable doubt on the drug sentencing crime. The officers aren't on trial for whether they improperly recorded.
Isn't it? You want to inject in the case the issue of good cause and or the issue of legality, which in turn depends on good cause. Then there has to be, someone has to make a determination whether there was good cause. Right?
I don't, no, I don't think I agree with that. There doesn't have to be a determination of good cause because that is the statute that looks at what the police officers were doing and whether that was legal or not. The jury is making a beyond a reasonable doubt question on drug possession.
But you can't just tell the jury that it's illegal to turn off a recorder. You have to tell them it's illegal to turn off a recorder unless there's good cause.
And that was in the instruction.
Then you and the government disagree over whether there's good cause. So doesn't that issue have to be hashed out in front of the jury?
It could certainly be argued to the jury, but they don't need to make a finding on that because that's not the underlying crime being charged.
They have to make a determination in order to determine what weight, if any, to give to the alleged violation of Wisconsin law. They have to know whether there's a violation.
The good cause part of the statute is something they ought to consider, just like the illegality part of the statute.
But then they need evidence.
Certainly.
They have to weigh evidence.
And there was evidence on that point. I mean,
you're not only asking the jury to decide Bruce's guilt, but to decide whether the detective violated the statute.
And this is exactly how it works in every state court in Wisconsin, and the fact that they chose to prosecute him federally rather than state should not let them out of having to give this instruction. If Wisconsin juries can do it, certainly federal juries can do it.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Murray, well, we thank you very much for your effort.